So today is the fourth introductory course. So before we start with the meditation, I thought to open it up a little bit if there's any questions you might have or anything you want to raise from the last week's instructions or the weeks before, or from your own experience of trying the meditation at home, and anything you want to ask about. It's said in Buddhism you make very good karma when you ask questions.
It's hard for me sometimes to distinguish between thoughts and emotion.
Oh, good. I don't think that they're so separated from each other. Emotions are a composite where they're made up of different elements. They're not like a unitary, single, essential thing. And one of the things that makes up an emotion at times is our thoughts and our thinking. And another thing that makes it up is our physical sensations in our body. Another thing that makes it up is our intention, what we want or don't want, kind of a reaction for or against something. There's many different things that make it up. And one of the things that happens is we start paying careful attention, we begin teasing apart those different elements. And then we start seeing how they relate to each other. How sometimes a thought arises, and that thought is a condition for more of an emotion, in a sense. And sometimes an emotion arises, and you see how that is a condition for certain kinds of thoughts or attitudes to arise, and how they relate.
While we're waiting, I have a question that I don't even know if it's worth asking, but I keep trying to think of what to do with my hands. I don't know if you've talked about that or not. I notice you've got your fingers woven, and I like to copy the statue. It's like this, and I've been told to have the thumbs just touching left over right. What do you say about hands?
She asked, you know, what do you do with your hands when you meditate? And generally, I tell people to do anything that's symmetrical and comfortable with the hands, so that both hands are doing the same thing. The classic way of meditating in Buddhism, kind of in many different Buddhist number of different Buddhist traditions, is to have the hands together, one on top of the other, with it, just the fingers overlapping. So that your fingers don't overlap onto the palm, just the fingers overlap. And then, and in one tradition, you have the right hand underneath and the left hand on top. And then you put your thumbs together and you make kind of an oval shape. It's called the cosmic mudra in Japanese Buddhism. And with the thumb tips very lightly touching. And it's very interesting. In Zen, that's the way they sit. And what happens is that this becomes a antenna or for what's going on internally as you meditate. If you get tense, sometimes you push your thumbs together. And that's an indication that you're tense, and so you kind of have to relax that. Or if you're really kind of getting complacent or sleepy in your meditation, your thumbs fall open. And that means you're kind of, you've lost it a little bit. And so by always keeping your thumb tips very lightly touching, it helps create some balance between relaxation and tension in sitting. And so it can be quite helpful. See, this Buddha, he has his right hand on top. But in the Zen tradition, what I was trained in, you only do that when you become fully enlightened. Until you become fully enlightened, you put your left hand on top. mostly for the last years, I've been sitting the hands either together, or more often than not, actually have them on my thighs, resting on my thighs with the palms facing down. I feel quite comfortable with that. I feel very stable, and it seems to work quite well. You can, as you see fit. Maybe one more question. Many people like to bow at the end of a sitting or at different times, and this gesture expresses can express various things. It's in Asia, it's often a form of greeting, and it's very nice. It's kind of like you put this lotus in front of your heart and kind of offer your gratitude or your respect to the heart of someone else. Some people like to do it at the end of a sitting to do it, and there's no requirement to do it. It's not like you have to come here and do that. And in that spirit, you can do it whatever way that suits you, whatever kind of how you move to do it. Some people like to do it in front of the hearts a little bit. Some people like to bring it up to their forehead. You know, some people like to kind of touch their heart and their forehead, and there's various ways of doing it. And often at the end of a sitting, I'll do it sometimes. And for me, it's simply an expression of gratitude and appreciation. Often when I sit, at the end of a sitting, I feel a certain kind of gratitude. Not really necessarily towards anything. It's not like an object for the gratitude, just objectless gratitude. It's one of the marvelous things about meditation. It's one of the ways we can have access to certain emotions or states of being, which in normal life generally have an object for their, for, you know, the reason for being there. In meditation, they can be there for no reason at all. And it's quite nice to realize you can have these wonderful senses of well-being without a reason. And because otherwise, we're always looking for a reason to, and a condition and an object for feeling good. And to realize you can just kind of bubble up for no reason in the letting go process of meditation can give a lot of confidence and a lot of delight in life and a lot more graciousness and ease as we go about life, because you realize that your inner well-being is not absolutely dependent on the conditions of the world being a certain way. And many of us are always adjusting the conditions of the world, the quality of life of issues, you know, our relationships, our jobs, our money, our comfort, our recreation opportunities, and, you know, all these things that we're kind of adjusting. If only those were just the right way, if only, then I'll be happy. And sometimes we are happy for a short while when we line everything up. But you can't line everything up to work just the right forever. And so it's nice to know that there's a capacity within us to feel happy, peaceful, delighted, love, without any of the conditions in the world causing it to be that way. And in fact, you can feel some of these things when the conditions in the world are quite unpleasant. And so why am I talking about this? Someone brought up a question? You brought up. No, why did I say? Bowing. Oh, so at the end of a sitting, sometimes I feel this gratitude. And there's no particular reason for the gratitude, you know, just like I could give a reason, but it's nice when you feel these things sometimes to give it expression. And this is one way, you know, rather than kind of hold it in yourself. So I find it's nice to give it expression like this. And some people will like to, some Buddhists like to chant. And one of the reasons to chant is to give expression to some of these feelings that are coming up. So let's start. I'd have to think about it a little bit. Nothing obvious. It's not like a manual that says, you know. But I mean, there are certain chants for loving kindness, certain chants for gratitude, and you know, so there are particular chants that kind of evoke or relate to certain ways of feeling. But I've never seen, you know, hard and fast, you know. So let's meditate. So take a comfortable but alert posture. Take an alert but comfortable posture. Gently close your eyes. And then begin the sitting by taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. Breathe deep down into your abdomen. And as you exhale, let go, relax into your body. And then let your breathing return to normal. And it's helpful at the beginning of a sitting, especially after the end of a day, to scan through your body to see if there's any obvious places of tension that you can relax. It can be nice to do this systematically, starting at the top of the head, the forehead, and feeling that part of your body. And then maybe as you exhale, let there be a softening, forehead, the eyebrows, scalp. And perhaps there can be a little relaxation of the eyes, corner of the eyes, letting the eyeballs rest in their sockets. If there's tension in the eyes or in the eyelids, and it's not easy to relax, be at ease with that. And if you feel any tension in your jaws, area of your mouth, cheeks, you might soften that relax. people hold tension is in the shoulders. You might first just feel the shoulders. Allow yourself to just feel them as they are without doing anything about it. And then the next few exhalations, see if there can be a softening of the shoulders, letting go. Also, it can be helpful to soften the belly. Probably more important than any other place in your body to relax in meditation. It's important to relax the stomach. To let the abdomen hang forward, be relaxed. And often, even if it's possible to relax the belly, if we're habituated to tense the belly, it'll tense up again right away. But a few times, two or three or four times in the course of a sitting, the beginning and other times, it can be helpful to relax that belly, soften it. And that can help the breathing be a little bit deeper and fuller. So the foundation, the usual foundation of mindfulness meditation is your breathing. If you have trouble finding your breath or noticing where in your body the breathing is felt, you can take and breathe a little bit more deeply, just teeny bit more for a few rounds. Some people will feel the breath primarily in their belly, the rising and falling of the belly. Some people will feel it more in their chest, the lifting and falling of the chest. Some people might feel it more in the nostrils, the air going in and out. Some people are more inclined to feel the whole breath body. Whichever way is the breath you're breathing is most accessible to you, most easiest to pay attention to. Let that be your home base for breathing. And there's this kind of a rhythm of breathing in and breathing out, breathing in. See if you can establish yourself in that rhythm. See if you can sustain the attention with your breathing over time. So you get a sense of that rhythm. That alternation. Inevitably, the mind will wander off into thoughts. And when you notice that, simply note it. Give recognition that that's happening. Gentle, accepting recognition that your mind is caught up in thoughts. And then begin again with your breathing. Begin again with some devotion or firmness, some clear resolve that you're starting again with the breath. Seeing if you can enter into the world of breathing, one breath after the other. You might find it helpful to very gently, softly, in the back of the mind, a whisper in the mind, to label each inhalation and exhalation. It could be in and out, or it can be rising and falling if you're staying present for the rising and falling of the abdomen or the chest. If the labeling is soft enough, but direct enough, it can help keep you on course. So you really sustain the attention on the succession of breaths, one after the other. It's very helpful in meditation to not be bothered by your thinking. if you find yourself wandering off into thought. No need to judge that or be harsh about that, or no need to jerk the mind back to the breathing. Find yourself thinking. Acknowledge that that's happening. In an easy way, easygoing way, begin again with your breathing. But with some dedication or some firmness with the breath, some real resolve. Okay, I'm going to stay here with this breathing. A kind of resolve that helps you relax with each breath. Relax into the breathing. Relaxing the thinking mind in favor of sensing the breathing. Just sensing how your breathing affects your body. Sensing the body's own experience of breathing. If you have thoughts in the background, but in the foreground of attention, you can stay with your breathing. That's fine. Be relaxed about those background thoughts. And stay with the breathing the best you can. Highlighting it. Surrendering to your breathing. And then as you're sitting here, if you find it difficult to be with the breathing, because something else is more pronounced or predominant, let go of the breathing now and let your awareness hold or embrace or look carefully at this thing that's happening, whether it's body sensations or feelings or even a very compulsive tendency to think. Be very accepting of it. Let this accepting awareness see it clearly for what it is. And perhaps having directly acknowledged what's making it difficult to be with the breathing, maybe then you can begin again with your breathing. Maybe this time it's a little bit easier. Or if it's not, you can let your accepting awareness, your open awareness, your watching, continue to be present for what else is predominant besides the breath. And now in the last couple of minutes of this sitting, last few minutes, if you'd like to, if it makes you more comfortable so you can pay more careful attention, you can shift your posture. You can adjust your posture if you'd like. And now the instructions is a little bit different. You can continue with the breathing as kind of an anchor to the present moment as you wish. But when you notice yourself thinking, whether it's periodically you start thinking or you're thinking all the time, let your attention notice the event of thinking and see what you're thinking about right now has no importance for this exercise. But rather, notice something about the quality of that inner voice that does your thinking. The tone of that inner voice. Is it hesitant or harsh? Is it fast or slow? Energized or depressed? Judgmental or accepting? Insistent or easygoing? As if you're listening to someone else's conversation and you're listening to the tone in which they're speaking, the quality, the emotional sense of the voice that you hear, or the energy level. So the exercise is to notice something about how you think, as opposed to what you're thinking about. And then take a couple of long, slow, deep breaths. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Oh, there were two parts, basically, to that last sitting. One was a meditation that was focusing predominantly on the breathing and being with your breath. And then at the very end, we switched to ask you to look a little bit, to investigate, in a sense. You can discover something about how you think, as opposed to what you're thinking about. Many of us are seemingly addicted to what we're thinking about and to thoughts. But many of us have never taken the time to discover something about how we think, the nature of the thinking itself. So I was wondering, if someone would be willing to talk a little bit about what you discovered, what this last meditation was like for you, what you found out about your thinking, or didn't find out, or make it a little bit louder, please. Yeah. Okay. Mirror of experience is a nice... It's not experience itself, it's a mirror of it. And some people live in the mirror. Get lost in the mirror. Yes. Great. Thank you.
I feel this across the chatter. Chatter is difficult. And I love the meditation. Why is that? But I think it's a huge challenge.
Could you notice a little bit the tone of that chatter? Is it just gentle and loving and relaxed and easygoing? And is it compulsive? So easygoing is not how it is. Easygoing is not how the chatter is. Someone else? Yes.
I noticed that I have thoughts and I also have mental pictures. And the thoughts are relatively coherent, but the pictures aren't. And when I open my eyes, there are many fewer pictures. I wonder sometimes whether it's better to go and meditate with my eyes closed, but the pictures run their course.
You could experiment with both ways. Maybe do a week of meditation each way and see what seems to help you the best. Some people think more in images than they do in words. That's just the way their mind works. And When we talk about mindfulness of thoughts, if a person is primarily visually oriented and makes images, just translate it to kind of seeing or to images. And it's possible, it's interesting sometimes to experiment with keeping your eyes closed and let the stream of images come, because it's possible, sometimes it's possible that it's a little bit coming from a little bit deeper place inside of us, subconscious place, than the conscious level of thinking, which is often where we control our. It's very logical and, you know, ordered. Sometimes it's very controlled. And it's often the surface of our life that, you know, we're kind of keeping things under control and keeping things understood. And the deeper wellsprings of our life sometimes don't belong to the same logic of things that are well controlled and well understood. And so that some, maybe the way you're describing it makes me wonder whether the images, the pictures, are bubbling up with something a little bit deeper. So it could be interesting to go with that. So you're commenting and analyzing your practice as you go along. That's what you're
having a good time, yeah. Full of humor and laughing and thinking, well, nobody knows what I'm thinking. This is great. I'm the one with the breathing. It doesn't want to stay with the breathing, because the breathing, when I call attention to it, tells me, you know, I can't breathe. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so you don't have to. I mean, breath doesn't have to be the focus of meditation, even though. Kind of generically, it's like for most people, it's very useful to be with a breath. But there are plenty of people for whom the breathing is not the right thing to pay attention to in meditation. And there's other things to be the anchor in the present moment besides the breath. A couple more. Did anybody get a sense of the tone of that voice, the inner voice? That makes sense as instructions to look at? How many of you had a really... Yeah? Please go ahead. Great. Very nice. Someone here? Can you speak a little bit louder? We internalize these things sometimes. Uh-huh. How many of you recognize other people's voices in there? So thinking is fascinating. It's an important part of who we are and our life. And in many ways, thinking helps us a lot in our life. We wouldn't negotiate our life very well without our thinking. On the other hand, our thinking also causes us tremendous amount of grief. And it could be argued that maybe the majority of our suffering and grief is directly related to our thoughts and how we relate to them and what they are. Some people who get into meditation will then have an aversive relationship to their thinking. And they think the point of meditation is to have no thoughts at all, to have a completely silent, empty mind. And the point of mindfulness meditation is not necessarily to have that, but rather is to have a friendly relationship, an open, accepting, silent relationship to whatever arises, and not to be aversive, not be for or against anything, not be for our thoughts or against our thoughts, but simply to learn how to be awake in the midst of what our experience is. And kind of the epitome of what Buddhist practice is focusing on is this experience of being awake in the middle of our experience. And being awake doesn't require our experience to be different. It doesn't require us to stop thinking. But you're awake to the fact that you're thinking. And as we are awake to it, the opportunity is there to shift our identity to the wakefulness, as opposed to having our identity tied into what we're thinking about or we're feeling. One of the interesting things to explore around thoughts in our thinking is there an unexamined assumption that you can believe your thoughts, that your thoughts are all believable and true. The unreflective life, sometimes people just believe every thought they have. It must be, this is the way it is. And I know sometimes still in me, I should know better after all these years of mindfulness, sometimes I can see that I have these certain kinds of thoughts and a certain mood that filters how I see things and think about things. And I'll think, this is how things really are. You know, I'll think that someone you know, some in my family, you know, they're really being awful today. And they might not be being awful. I'm in an awful mood. And I have this thought about them, and I believe that thought. Sometimes our thoughts are actual kind of real perception of what's going on out there. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're pure fantasy. I've had complete fantasy about what's going on. My favorite little story like this that I tell a lot is Sylvia Borstein, a Vipassana teacher, called up the San Francisco Zen Center many years ago to... She wanted to go there and be a guest for a few days. So she called the office and asked, can I, be a guest? And they said, we have to talk to the guest manager, but he's not in. He'll call you back. So later he called her, but she wasn't in. So he left a message and said, this is Robert, the guest manager at Zen Center, and call me when you get in. So when she got in, she called him back, called back to the office, and asked, can I speak to Robert, the guest master? And they said, oh, he's not in now. And so then Sylvia said, oh, I guess this means that it wasn't meant for me to be at Zen Center, go to Zen Center. And the office person said, no, I think what this means is that Robert's not in. And she was so quick to want to add a layer of interpretation, a meaning on top of the situation. And she was going to believe that meaning as if this really was what was really going on. And in good Zen form, the Zen Center person said, no, it just means he's not in. You know, you don't have to believe your meaning. So how do we relate to our thinking? Do we kind of automatically assume that what we're thinking is true and accurate reflection of the world? Or some people, it's the opposite. They're afraid of their thoughts. They're plagued by their thoughts. And, you know, please, you know, anything to drown out my thoughts. And some people turn on their radio or television or anything so they can be with, so they don't have to be with their thinking, because their thinking is so anguished and painful. But then also there's sometimes a kind of belief in the thoughts. Running away from thinking that way is actually, in the long term, counterproductive. It's fascinating to track your thinking a little bit and to track kind of things you think about, whether it's mostly memory or planning or fantasy or commentary or judgments. And, you know, there's a lot of things. Some people have real patterns follow through them, you know, day after day or year after year or lifetime after lifetime, you know, just certain ways in which tracks are really well laid down. We tend to fall into those grooves over and over again. It's interesting to know that and see that and become aware of that so that you know how those grooves influence how you see life and how you see yourself. It's also interesting to notice what you're paying attention to notice how often it's self-reflective, how often it has to do with me, myself, and mine, how what's happening in the world relates to me, how it's a lot of comparative thought goes on about me and myself and how I compare myself to others in different situations. And it's very interesting to see. As I like to point out, if someone followed me around and spoke into my ear as much as I speak to myself, as constantly as I speak to myself, and as repetitively as I speak to myself, I would ask them to be quiet, I would beg them to be quiet, I'd bribe them to be quiet, I'd threaten them to be quiet, I'd call the psychiatrist and say, this person, you know, should probably be institutionalized. I mean, how many times can one person say the same thing, you know? But what's interesting is that, so I can do that if someone's talking to me this way, but if it's inside my head, I'm talking to myself, what's interesting is how interesting it always is. And I can think the same thing 500 times, and it's still just as interesting as the first time. And why is that? And I suspect a lot of it is because it's self-referential, and that's very interesting for us. Few of us are tired of me, myself, and mine. So it's interesting to kind of track and find out what's going on with our thinking. And it's a helpful part of Buddhist practice, of mindfulness practice, and so we're not so influenced by our thoughts and the content of them, and so they don't necessarily shape our view of what's going on in the world so drastically. And also, so we can start waking up in the midst of them, and kind of be clear about what's going on. Not be caught. To be awake is not to be caught by anything, not be caught by those thoughts. So one of the descriptions in Buddhism of how to be mindful of thoughts is to imagine thoughts as clouds drifting through an empty sky. But, you know, and sometimes it's, our thoughts are far from that. Sometimes they're like the bullet train, you know, they're just kind of racing by, you know, and you're on it. But, you know, the clouds drifting in endless empty sky, just kind of just, there's no problem with thought, just there. You don't have to pick it up. You don't have to grab onto it. You don't have to engage in it. You don't have to follow through on it. You don't have to, you know, analyze it. Just a thought by itself. I like to differentiate between thoughting and thinking. And thinking we all know about, right? But thoughting is just what the mind does. The mind's a thoughting machine. It just produces thoughts. What we do is we get involved in those thoughts. Oh, that was a great idea I had. You know, I can't believe I was thinking that, my God. Or, yeah, she said that, and then if, next time I see her, I'm going to tell her that, and she'll probably tell me that in return, and then I'll tell her this. And you know, we're going on and on and on. We're so involved. And so the chain of associated thinking, you know, free association kind of thing, where they all kind of build on each other and follow each other. There's no need to stop our thoughting. But what's interesting is how we get involved with our thoughts. We react to it. We buy into it. We get interested in it. We, you know, that's what's interesting in mindfulness. To be awake is to no longer buy into it or latch on to the thought. Just let it be there. It's okay. If imagine, you know, no one's ever actually seen a thought, have they? Have you ever seen a thought? I mean, they're so central to your lives, right? But have you ever seen a thought? Have you, you know? You know, can you paint it? Can you write a picture? You know, have you picked? You know, you have. Yeah, what is your? I've never seen one. What does it look like? Oh, that way you see little graphs or a little kind of. How do you know it's a thought? So it lights up when you have a thought. So Jerry has seen his thoughts. You see, or
you thought.
Now, is it that you've seen your thought, your thoughting, or is it that you've seen the influence your thought had on its system?
I was being ironic.
Oh, I see. Oh, let's come back then. But anyway, so the story I was going to say is, you know, it's like I don't think anybody's really seen a thought. You kind of like, and but imagine, you know, NASA sends out a probe deep into the galaxy, and lo and behold, there's a thought out there that's floating in the sky, you know, in space, and no one's ever seen one. But there, finally, after all these millennia, there's a thought. You can see what they look like, and it's so fascinating. No one's ever seen one. They get really excited back at NASA, and they're. Can't wait to let everyone know. Everyone in the world is excited to see what the first photograph is of a real thought, you know. And people see this first thought and just fascinating. They had no idea it had that shape and that contour and that font. And wow, you know. And it was so much more, you know, and the fact that it was a beautiful thought or an evil thought would be almost secondary to the amazement of a thought. Or like the thought that you're having, you're about to have, or you're having, you know, about to have now, whatever it's going to be in a moment. When I ring the bell, right? The next thought you have after I ring this bell, you can reflect and think that that's the culmination of 5 billion years of evolution. Wow! 5 billion years of evolution, I'm thinking about pizza. Or, you know, it's just amazing. It's just one of the most amazing things. And we're so caught up in the drama of it, and just like, we're in the middle. We're not, how often are you amazed by this thinking, you know, there's 5 billion years of evolution, it comes down to this moment. We take our thoughts so seriously, so heavy, and so as a final arbitrator of meaning and who we are and, you know, everything. Some people define themselves as who they are as human being by what they think. We think we are what we think. And if you are what you think, what happens in those moments when there's no thoughts? There's a joke, you probably, if I tell you the joke, you'll leave because you've heard it so many times, but Descartes says, you know, I think, therefore I am. And so he goes to the bar, right? Have you heard all this? Should I not say this terrible joke?
No.
So Descartes goes to the bar and he orders a drink. And he drinks it, and then the bartender says, "You want one more?" And he says, "I think not." And then he disappears. So sorry. So thoughts are an important part of our life, and there's a lot we can become aware of in our thinking. The trick with mindfulness of thinking is then not to get caught up in more thinking about it, but have this silent, non-discursive awareness. You just sees it, and to be awake, there's something non-discursive, something silent about wakefulness that doesn't require us to get sucked in and thinking about it. It just allows it to be as it is. So when we're meditating, we usually have something as the anchor to the present moment to help, because it's very hard to just kind of stay anchored in the present moment. We generally use in our tradition the breath. Some people find the breath doesn't work. An alternative is just to do body sensations, to be in your body. And just very globally with the body, just be with your body, stay in the body. Some people, another alternative some people like is sounds. Sounds are always happening in the present moment. So you just open to the sounds. And you stay with the sound, the mind drifts off, and you come back to sounds and listening. We use something as an anchor. And I suggest most of you really try with the breath until you have good evidence that you should do something else. And the breath is very helpful to develop concentration and stillness, relaxation, help you be in the present moment. But at some point, if it's really difficult to stay with the breathing, then you want to let go of the breath and let this non-discursive awareness of meditation really acknowledge, really be present for what it is that's making it difficult for you to be with the breath. It might be body sensations, it might be emotions, but it can also be thoughts. So if it's just kind of surface chatter of the mind, you can just kind of let go of it and come back to your breathing. But sometimes thinking is really compulsive and really it's really hard to let go of it. It's there kind of churning away. And you really want to then turn your attention and really kind of look at it head on. You really acknowledge it fully. And kind of, as silently as you can. Awake, kind of as the observer, silent observer, noticing this thinking that's happening. Because we have this wonderful capacity of knowing what's going on, being aware of what's going on while it's happening. You can be aware of thinking while it's happening. And the awareness of thinking is not another kind of thinking. It's kind of silent sensing, in a sense. So you want to just acknowledge. And you can maybe very gently, as a whisper in the mind, say to yourself, thinking, thinking, planning, planning, remembering, remembering. Somehow, the more clearly you can acknowledge what it is, the kind of thinking, sometimes it frees us a little bit from it. We're not so entangled with it then. And sometimes if you look at the thought head on, just fully acknowledge it, sometimes it just vanishes. It goes away by itself. It isn't that you want it to go away, but that's often what happens. What you want to do is just learn how to be awake in the midst of what's happening. Sometimes thoughts are more compelling. They're really compulsive. They stay for a long time. And then just stay there very gently, very friendly and loving way, if you can, with just thinking, 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 just being, and begin exploring it. What is it like, this thinking? What about how you think that's different than the content? Does it feel like very energized, very powerful, very forceful? Does it feel hesitant, fearful? What does it feel like energetically in the body? If it's really compulsive, your thinking, you might feel tension in your forehead or your eyebrows and your eyes or in your shoulders, your neck, on your stomach sometimes even. There's often a physical aspect to compulsive thinking. And you can bring your attention and ground yourself in the physicality of what it likes to be thinking this way. Because then you're really with the process of thinking. You're with the physical part of it, which helps us not get caught up by the story. And that's part of the trick in meditation, not be caught by the story of what you're thinking about, but to really, really separate yourself from the story, just be with what's happening in the present moment in and of itself. So ground yourself in your body. And I find sometimes if I have a lot of anxious thinking, to find out where that anxiousness is felt in the body, then it helps settle that anxiety. The marvelous thing about this meditation, I find, one of the marvelous things, is there are times I find myself anxious, upset, thinking about something, some problem, and it's like this closed loop. Someone once described thinking as, Chögyam Trungpa described thinking as the epitome of the human condition is a traffic jam of discursive thought. And then someone told me, oh, it's like a freeway off-ramp, like a figure eight that puts you right back on the freeway, kind of goes around and around, you're always on. It's kind of closed-loop systems, kind of like. And what I find is that sometimes that my solutions to my problems or what I'm trying to figure out doesn't come from thinking about it and solving it through thoughts. It comes from learning to relax and step outside of the stream of thinking and relaxing outside of it. That makes sense at all to you? And so to know that that's the case really helps me a lot, because then until I knew that, I was always kind of staying in my thought and attached, addicted to them. And now I know there's another way. And my whole perception of the situation can change radically if I can relax behind that kind of traffic jam of thoughts that I can be caught in sometimes. So energetically, what does it feel like to be there? And sometimes that's very helpful. Sometimes it's helpful to be mindful of the emotional quality of the thinking. If thoughts are very compulsive and very predominant and really making it difficult for you to be with the breathing, chances are fairly good there's an emotional aspect to it that's fueling it. And so you can open up and be aware of that emotional aspect of it. If there's people plan a lot in meditation. 90% of the time, it's because there's some anxiety or some fear that's part of that event. And if you can ground yourself in the fear, there's no need then anymore to produce those planning thoughts. It's almost like the thoughts are a camouflage for the fear. And if you really want to connect to what's really real, you want to connect to the emotion that's the emotion of the thinking, not to the thoughts themselves. So memory sometimes also is saying there can be a particular emotion that can be connected to it. Fantasy, the same thing. Sometimes fantasy, it could be really what's kind of the emotional tone that's kind of behind it, besides the excitement and delight of a particular fantasy sometimes, can sometimes be a sense of loneliness or emptiness. And the task of meditation then is to ground the attention or to wake this wakeful attention to feel what the emotion is like. If you do that, then sometimes that pulls out the fuel for being lost in our thoughts over and over again. It helps settle it and relax it. Sometimes our thinking is quite compulsive and painful, a lot of judgments, and doesn't seem to want to stop. And you can be as mindful as you kind of try to be. And in the end, what you really need to do is to learn to love it. You know, bring a friendliness to it. It's you, after all. Imagine that there's, a 4-year-old girl or a boy who is really tired and hasn't eaten for a while and is really acting out and is really getting kind of angry and hitting and throwing things. And what do you do for that child? There are probably different strategies different people do, but if you go kind of yell at the kid and block him in the room and, say, you're terrible and awful, it just kind of makes the kid feel worse. If you kind of say, oh, come here, and you hold the kid, let me go feed you, and let me help you get a nap. It's okay, you're okay. The kid feels much more welcome and nice. So a little bit, that analogy is the same with the mind. If you have this thing you really hate about yourself, you're really plagued by the way you're thinking all the time, or certain emotions, certain tendencies, and you try to be mindful of it, and it's still kind of plaguing you and troubling you, maybe more than mindfulness, what you need is to be friendly to it and loving of it or accepting of it and to bring kind of a tenderness to it, like you would to a 4-year-old child that, would feel awful if it felt rejected and hated, and awful if it was told, you're the problem, and if only I got rid of you, then my life would be great. I mean, I've known of kids who grew up that way with that attitude from their parents, and it's just really a terrible thing, the way of growing up. And sometimes we internalize these things in our voice, So sometimes love is really the right thing to do. Is these things all making sense? Do you have any questions? Yes. Yeah. So, for example, you can feel the emotion in your body, the fear in your body. Because the body is always, the fear is often not in the present moment. The body is always in the present moment. So the fear is often, if it's not in the present moment, it's in a story, what might happen. And so, often 90% of the time it's about fear, which is, you know, far away, you know, the possibility. And so to ground ourselves in the body, and the emotion is to feel it in the body, and then to be with it, don't push it away, don't try to fix it, but just feel it in your body. And the word emotion means, in Latin, the emotion means motion, movement. And the E in Latin means out. So emotion has the meaning of to be moving out. Emotions are always in process, always moving. Unless we freeze them, unless we hold them through our attachments, our thoughts, our resistance, our clinging. So for example, resentment is frozen anger. If you feel, so if you're resentful, for example, and you get tight, if you're holding anger, you're probably tight a little bit somewhere. If you feel that tightness, say your fist is tight, if you just feel it very lovingly and gently, the natural tendency of that tightness is to want to relax. And it'll begin to relax, it'll move out. So if you ground your emotions in your body and feel the emotion there, often the emotion will move itself out and change and transform. If you keep engaging the emotion in the thoughts and the story and all that, sometimes we just kind of wind ourselves up more and more. So grounding ourselves in the emotion is to ground it in the physical body and just feel it and be with that there. And then you're there in the present moment, which is really what we're trying to do the most here. We're not trying to process our emotions. We're just trying to be what's in the present. And you're in the present in your body, but it's much more difficult to do that in the story. Make sense? Yeah, can you speak loudly? Because it's just.
How would you recognize a thought even if you thought it?
How would you recognize it even if you thought? Well, I think I would just rely on NASA telling me that they found it. I know that I'm thinking. There's a kind of an inner sense organ that knows when I'm thinking. So I know pretty well when I'm thinking, and you know, so I don't know more than that what to say. Well, if it's a sentence, if it's words, or if it's pictures, if you have inner words where you're speaking to yourself or talking to yourself, or there are images inside your mind that you're kind of relating to, those are thoughts. Does that make sense? One of the great, I was on retreat once, 10-day retreat, silent retreat. And I was doing walking meditation back and forth. And we do walking meditation in the same place, kind of a walkway that's about 30 feet long. We simply walk back and forth. And I was, you know, walking along, minding my own business. And I came, and I was actually lost in my thoughts. But I came to near the end of the pass. And then what you do is you turn around, and then you cover the same ground again, going the opposite direction. So I came to the end, I was last few steps, turned around, and took a couple of steps in the other direction. And I realized that now I was in exactly the same place I had been 2 seconds earlier. Same place on the earth, just 2 seconds later. I was facing the other direction. And I thought, what happened to that thought I had 2 seconds ago? I kind of looked around. Where did it go? 2 seconds ago, it was so important. It was like the most substantial thing in the world. Like I was so engaged, it was so important. And 2 seconds later, where'd it go? We relate to our thoughts sometimes as if the most solid and important thing in the whole world, and in fact, are the most insubstantial thing in the whole world. Isn't that amazing? We take the most insubstantial thing to be really the central organizing kind of ground for our life, and it's, where is it? Thoughts are fascinating. I love them. I mean, I have a very friendly relationship to my thoughts. And But, you know, they cause a lot of trouble, too. It's like, you know, being in a committed relationship. You know, you love the person, but, you know, sometimes you have your problems. So it's like that with my thoughts, too, you know. But, you know, basically, you know, it's friendly. The best, one of the best instructions around thoughts in terms of meditation came from Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master in San Francisco, who said, don't be bothered by them. That's really helpful. Don't be bothered by them. So you just kind of don't get caught by them, let go of them. Just stay with your breath. So I hope this makes sense. The idea in meditation is to stay very simple. Wakefulness is a very simple quality of the mind. It's kind of like, wakefulness is kind of like the spotlight of light that you shine whatever's going on. So sometimes you, if the room is dark, you shine it on your breath. Sometimes if something really loud sound is coming from over there, you shine it on there, and what you see is there's a body sensation. Sometimes some loud commotion is happening over here, and you shine the light on your emotions. Sometimes there's all these thoughts going on, and you shine the light there. And after a while, you get a sense that you have this light, this wonderful light that you can shine on different aspects. And the light itself is independent of your breath, of your feelings, of your thoughts, of what's happening in the world around you. And you start appreciating this light. Wow, this light is actually is always kind of peaceful, or always kind of free. Or the light itself becomes really an important part of our life. So part of it is, what we're doing in mindfulness is developing that light, that awareness, that wakefulness. They can notice and be aware and be aware. The idea is to keep it simple. So stay with the breath, and something else becomes predominant. Let this silent, discursive awareness take that in, be accepting of it, allowing of it. Just be awake to it. Oh, this is what's happening now, right now. Just this much is happening now. And then when thoughts are happening, you want to do the same thing with that. Just, oh, thinking is happening. For some beginners in meditation, it's very hard to include mindfulness of thinking as part of your meditation because it's hard to understand what it means. It sounds like we're getting very busy, and we start thinking about what's going on. If you're a relatively beginner in meditation, these instructions might have been helpful, might be helpful. Or if it's not so helpful now, kind of put it on the shelf for a few months. And just be very simple with the breath and the body, and just kind of stay grounded in that for a while and develop that. You can go really far just doing that. And then, you know, sometime in the future you can pick up this thing around thoughts. Does that make sense? Let's think about it. So let's end with one more sitting. You've been sitting enough for a while, so if you'd like to stand and just for 30 seconds or so and stretch, and you know, whatever you feel like you want to do to kind of loosen up your legs. So one of the aids to mindfulness, which not all mindfulness students use, but it's very helpful for many people, is this very quiet, silent whisper of naming your experience as you're having it. Not to get lost in the name, but they say 95% of what you're doing is being with the experience, sensing the experience. And 5% is kind of nudging your mind, encouraging your mind to stay present there by having this little name, kind of in, out, or hardness, softness, tingling, hearing, sadness, happy, thinking. And a very gentle kind of stream, constant kind of movement, gentle, easygoing stream, just naming what's going on, can be very helpful to keep you in the present. Because as long as you're naming, you're in the present. Some people don't like to do this naming, labeling practice, because it sounds like it's more discursive thought, more activity of the mind. But if you're really honest about how often you're in the present moment, you might find that actually this keeps you more in the present. And the practice opens up. So, sit upright. Let your eyelids close gently. Release your belly. Take two long, slow, deep breaths. Let your breathing return to normal. And then ground yourself in your breathing. Breathing in and breathing out. And for these next little short sitting, experiment with labeling your experience as you're having it. Easygoing, relaxed. As quiet a whisper in your mind as you can. Don't get caught up in the labeling. Let it be kind of in the background so that it helps you with the foreground stay present for your experience. And do it with the breathing. And if some other experience becomes pronounced, body sensations, emotions, thoughts, let that easygoing stream of labeling help you to be awake to the presence of those things. If something stays predominant for a long time, just stay there for a long time with that. If what's predominant changes, let your awareness move with the changes. If you're not sure what to do, come back to your breathing. The breathing is really invaluable for most of us. If all you do is mindfulness of breathing or mindfulness of body sensations or sound, it's just really great. There's one more week to this class. Next week is the last week, last class meeting for the five-week class. And then the following Thursdays of March, we have a regular Thursday sitting group during the same time. That the Thursday group is often oriented a little bit more towards beginners. So some of you might want you want more support to continue coming for the next weeks. Since this is the last week, I'd like to encourage you, if you're new to all this and you've been following along at home, is extend now your sittings at home to 25 minutes each day, just for this week. After this week, you can go back and do whatever you want. But push yourself a little bit if this is all new to you and see what happens if you, with the 25 minutes, if you find it helpful or interesting or... The other thing is, next week I won't be here though. Next week's the last class, and I won't be teaching it because I'm leaving tomorrow to teach a month-long retreat up at Spirit Rock in Marin County. And Carolyn Dilley, who is teaches this class in San Jose, and is one of our senior students, longtime practitioner, and a lovely woman, lovely teacher, will come and do the last week of this class. And then in March, we do another round of the five-week intro class. I think maybe they're starting the first week in March. First Thursday. We're switching it to Wednesday. So if you're interested in doing this again, I think it's the first Wednesday of March we do another five-week intro class. And this Saturday, we have a one-day meditation retreat taught by Howie Cohn, who's one of the Spirit Rock teachers. And you're welcome to come to that. It's no registration required. Just come here at 9 o'clock, by 9 o'clock. It starts at 9. And if you're new to all this, and you can just come for, for the morning if you'd like, or just come for a while. And when you've had enough, you can just quietly go. So, any questions that before we end for the evening? Anything you need to...
The topic next week is...
Oh, next week is kind of a little bit of summary of all this, but more importantly, how to integrate this into daily life, how this applies to our life. It's a very important class and topic. So anyway, since this is my last day for this class, I want to thank you all very much, and it was very nice, and I do hope this has served you and helped you in some way or other. And our sitting group here is, purpose of our center here is to support you all in your practice. And if there's ways to support you, please come and participate here. Thank you.